his face distorted, but without swaying on his feet. And the great hall became as still as if all present had stopped breathing. As for the adder-head, he applauded.
"Well, look at that!" he cried. "Is there anyone here in this hall who thinks he could have survived that sword stroke? He's just a little pale, that's all. Am I right, Firefox?"
His herald did not reply, but just stood there staring at the blood-stained sword in his hands. But the Adderhead went on, in a voice of high good humor.
"Well, I think that proves it. The girl wasn't lying, and the Adderhead is not a gullible fool who fell for a child's fairy tale, is he?"
He placed his words as carefully as a beast of prey places its paws. Nothing but silence answered him. Even Firefox, his face white with pain, said not a word as he wiped his own blood from the sword blade.
"Excellent," remarked the Adderhead. "That's done, then. And now I have an immortal herald. It's time I was able to say the same of myself. Piper," he said, turning to the man with the silver nose, "empty the hall for me. Get everyone out. Servants, women, physicians, clerks, all of them. I want just 10 men-at-arms to stay. The librarian, you and Firefox, and the 2 prisoners. You go away, too," he snapped at Mortola, who was about to protest. "Stay with my wife and get that baby to stop crying at last."
"What's he going to do, Mo?" whispered Maggie as the hall emptied around them. But he could only shake his head. He didn't know yet either. He only felt that the game was far from over yet.
"What about us?" he called to the Adderhead. "My daughter and I have fulfilled our part of the bargain, so fetch the prisoners from your dungeons and let us go."
But the Adderhead only raised his hands in a conciliatory gesture.
"Yes, of course, Blue Jay," he graciously replied.
"As you have kept your word, I keep mine, the Adder's word of honor. I've already sent men down to the dungeons, but it's a long way from there to the gate, so give us the pleasure of your company a little longer. Believe me, we shall provide you with entertainment."
"A game." Mo looked around and saw the huge doors close behind the last servants. Once empty, the hall only seemed larger.
"Well, how are you doing, Firefox?" The Adderhead ran a cool eye over his herald. "What does it feel like to be immortal? Fabulous? Reassuring?"
Firefox said nothing. He was still holding the sword that had run him through.
"I'd like my own sword back," he said hoarsely, without taking his eyes off his master. "This one is no good."
"Nonsense! I'll have a new sword forged for you. A better one, in gratitude for the service you've done me today," replied the Adderhead. "But first we have one small thing to do so that we can remove your name from my book without any damage."
"Remove it?"
Firefox's eyes wandered to the Piper, who opened the book again and held it out to the librarian.
"Remove it, yes. You remember that originally the book was made to make me immortal, not you, and for that to happen, the scribe must write 3 more words in it."
"What for?"
Firefox wiped the sweat from his brow with his sleeve.
3 words. Poor devil.
Did he hear the trap snapping shut? Maggie reached for Mo's hand.
"To make room, one might say, to make room for me," replied the Adderhead. "And do you know what?" he went on as Firefox looked at him uncomprehendingly. "As a reward for your unselfish proof of how reliably this book really does protect one from death, as soon as the scribe has written those 3 words, you may kill the Blue Jay, if he can be killed, that is. Well, is it a fair offer?"
"What? What are you talking about?"
Maggie's voice was shrill with fear, but Mo quickly put his hand over her mouth. "Maggie, please," he said, low-voiced. "Have you forgotten what you said about Finolio's words? Nothing will happen to me, do you hear me?"
But she wouldn't listen. She sobbed and held him tightly until two men-at-arms roughly dragged her away.
Three words.
Firefox was advancing on him. And hadn't he just been feeling sorry for him?
You're a fool, Mortimer, thought Mo. Three words. Count them well, Blue Jay, said Firefox, raising his sword. On four, I shall strike, and it will hurt. I promise you, even if it may not kill you, I know what I'm talking about.
The sword blade shone like ice in the candlelight. It looked long enough to run three men through it once. And here and there, Firefox's blood still clung to the bright metal like rust.
Come now, Taddeo, said the Adderhead. You remember the words I told you. Write them one by one, but don't say them aloud. Just count them for us.
The piper opened the book and held it out to the old man. With trembling fingers, Taddeo dipped his pen in the jar of ink.
One,
he whispered, and the pen scratched over the parchment.
Two.
Firefox, smiling, set the point of the sword against Mo's chest. Taddeo raised his head, dipped his pen in the ink again, and looked uncertainly at the Adderhead.
Have you forgotten how to count, old man? He asked.
Taddeo just shook his head and lowered the pen to the paper again.
Three,
he whispered. Mo heard Meggy call his name and stared at the point of the sword. Words, nothing but words, protected him from that sharp, bright blade. In Finoleo's world, words were enough. Firefox's eyes widened in mingled astonishment and horror. Mo saw him try with his last breath to thrust the sword into him, to take him to wherever pen and ink were sending him to, but the sword dropped from his hands. Firefox collapsed like a bundle of empty clothes and fell at Mo's feet. The piper stood there staring down at the dead man in silence, while Taddeo lowered his pen and retreated from the book in which he had just been writing, as if it might kill him as well, with a quiet voice, with a single word.
"Take him away," ordered the Adderhead, "before the white women come to fetch him from my castle. Get on with it."
Three men-at-arms carried Firefox out. The foxtails on his cloak dragged on the tiles as they hauled him away, and Mo stood there staring at the sword lying at his feet. He felt Meggy put her arms around him. Her heart was beating like a frightened bird's.
"Who wants an immortal herald?" remarked the Adderhead as the dead Firefox was removed. "If you'd been a little cleverer, you'd have seen that for yourself."
The jewels that adorned his nostrils looked more than ever like drops of blood.
"Shall I remove his name, Your Grace?"
Taddeo's voice was so hesitant that it was barely audible.
"Of course. His name and the three words, you understand. And do a thorough job of it. I want the page as white as newly fallen snow again."
The librarian obediently set to work. The scraping sound was curiously loud in the empty hall. When Taddeo had finished, he passed the flat of his hand over the parchment, which was blank again now. Then the piper took the book from his hands and offered it to the Adderhead. Mo saw the man's stout fingers shaking as they dipped the pen in the ink. And before he began to write, the Adderhead looked up once more.
"I'm sure you weren't stupid enough to bind any kind of extra magic into this book, were you? Blue Jay?"
he asked warily.
"There are ways of killing a man, and not just a man, but his wife and daughter, too, that make dying a very long and very painful business. It can take days, and many nights."
"Magic?"
"No.
replied Mo, still staring at the sword at his feet. I don't know anything about magic. Let me say it again. Bookbinding, and nothing else, is my trade, and all I know about it has gone into that book. No more, and no less. Very well. The Adderhead dipped the pen in the ink again, and stopped once more. White, he murmured, staring at the blank pages. See how white they are. White as the women who bring death. White as the bones the cold man leaves behind when he's had his fill of flesh and blood. Then he wrote his name in the blank book, and closed it.
That's done! He cried triumphantly. That's done, Tadeo! Lock him in the book, the soul swallower, the enemy who can't be killed. Now he can't kill me either. Now we're equals, two cold men ruling the world together for all eternity.
The librarian obeyed, but as he was engaging the clasps, he looked at Mo.
Who are you?
His eyes seemed to ask.
What's your part in this game?
But even if Mo had wanted to, he couldn't have given him the answer. The Adderhead, however, seemed to think he knew it.
You know, I like you, Blue Jay, he said, never taking his lizard-like gaze off Mo. Yes, you'd make a good herald. But that's not the way the parts are shared out, is it?
No, indeed not, said Mo. But you don't know who shares them out. And I do, he added in his thoughts. The Adderhead nodded to the men-at-arms.
Let him go, he ordered. And the girl, and anyone else he wants to take.
They stepped aside, if reluctantly.
Come on, Mo, whispered Maggie, pressing his hand.
How pale she was, pale with fear, and so defenseless. Mo looked past the men-at-arms and thought of the walled courtyard waiting for them out there. The silver vipers staring down. The openings for boiling pitch above the gate. He thought of the crossbows of the guards on the battlements, too. The spears of the guards at the gate. And the soldiers who had pushed Risa down in the dirt. Without a word, he bent down and picked up the sword that had fallen from Fire Fox's hand.
Mo!
Maggie let go of his hand and looked at him in horror.
What are you doing?
But he just pulled her close to him without a word, while the men-at-arms all drew their weapons. Fire Fox's sword weighed heavy, heavier than the one he had used to chase Capricorn out of his house.
Well, fancy that, said the Adderhead. You don't seem to trust my word, Blue Jay.
Oh, I trust it, said Mo, without lowering the sword. But everyone here except me has a weapon. So I think I'll keep this masterless sword. You keep the book, and if we're both lucky, we'll never see each other again after this morning. Even the Adderhead's laughter sounded as if it were made of silver, dark, tarnished silver.
Well now, he said, it's a pleasure to play games with you, Blue Jay. You're a good opponent, which is why I'll keep my word. Let him go, he told the men-at-arms again. Tell the guards at the gate the Adderhead is letting the Blue Jay go because he need never fear him again, for the Adderhead is immortal.
The words echoed in Mo's ears as he took Maggie's hand. Tadeo was still holding the book, holding it as if it might bite him. Mo thought he could still feel its paper between his fingers, the wood of the boards, the leather covering it, the thread stitching the pages. Then he saw Maggie's gaze. She was staring at the sword in his hand, as if it made a stranger of him.
Come on, he said. Let's join your mother.
Yes! Go, Blue Jay! Take your daughter and your wife, and all the others, the Adderhead called after them. Before Mortola reminds me how stupid it is to let you go free.
Only two men-at-arms followed them on their long journey through the castle. The courtyard was almost empty at this early hour of the morning. The sky above the castle of night was gray, and a fine rain was falling like a veil before the face of the dawning day. A few servants already at work retreated in alarm from the sight of the sword in Mo's hand, and the men-at-arms waved them aside without a word. The other prisoners were already waiting at the gate, a forlorn little troop guarded by a dozen soldiers. At first Mo couldn't see Risa, but suddenly one figure moved away from the others and ran toward him and Maggie. No one stopped her. Perhaps the soldiers had heard of Fire Fox's fate. Mo felt their eyes on him full of horror and fear. The man who bound death between white pages and was a robber into the bargain. Didn't the sword in his hand prove that for all time? He didn't care what they thought. Let them be afraid of him. He had felt more than enough fear for one lifetime in all those days and nights when he thought he had lost everything, his wife, his daughter, and there was nothing left for him but a lonely death in this world made of words. Risa hugged him and Maggie in turn. She almost crushed them, and his face was wet with her tears when she let go of him again. "Come on, let's go through the gate, Risa," he urged in a low voice. "Before the lord of this castle changes his mind, we all have a great deal to tell one another, but for now, let's go." The other prisoners joined them in silence. They watched incredulously as the gate opened for them, as its iron-bound wings swung open and let them go free. Some of them stumbled over their own feet in their haste as they crowded out, but still no one from the castle followed them. The guards just stood there, swords and spears in their hands, staring as the prisoners stumbled uncertainly away, their legs stiff from weeks in the dungeons. Only one man-at-arms came out of the gate with them, wordlessly indicating the path they should take. "Suppose they shoot at us from the battlements," Mo thought, when he saw that there was not a single tree or bush to give them cover as they followed the road down the bare slope. He felt like a fly on the wall, ready to be swatted. But nothing happened. They walked through the gray morning, through the rain now pouring down, with the castle crouched menacingly behind them like a monster. And nothing happened.
"He's keeping his promise,"
Mo heard the others whispering these words more and more often.
"The Adderhead is keeping his word."
Risa asked anxiously about his wound, and he replied quietly that he was all right, while he waited to hear footsteps behind them, soldiers' footsteps. But all was still. It seemed as if they had been going down the bare hillside for an eternity when the trees suddenly appeared in front of them. The shade that their branches cast on the road was as dark as if night itself had taken refuge under them. Chapter 71. Only a Dream. Dustfinger was lying among the trees, drenched to the skin by the rain, with Fareed beside him. The boy's black hair clung to his forehead, and he kept shivering. The others were certainly in no better shape. They had been waiting for hours. They'd taken up their positions before sunrise, and it had been raining ever since. It was dark under the trees, as dark as if day had never dawned, and quiet, as quiet as if the waiting men were not alone in holding their breath. Only the noise of the rain splashed and dripped on the trees and branches, falling and falling. Fareed wiped his wet nose on his sleeve. And someone sneezed somewhere.
"Stupid fool, hold your nose,"
thought Dustfinger. Then started when he heard something rustling on the other side of the road. But it was only a rabbit scuttling out of the thickets. It stopped in the middle of the road, sniffing the air, ears twitching, eyes wide open. "It's probably no half as scared as I am," thought Dustfinger, wishing himself back with Roxanne in the dark underground galleries of the mine. They smelled like a crypt, but at least they were dry. He was pushing his dripping hair back from his forehead for about the 100th time when Fareed, beside him, suddenly raised his head. The rabbit raced away among the trees, and footsteps sounded through the rushing of the rain. Here they came at last, a forlorn little troop, almost as wet as the robbers waiting for them. Fareed was going to jump up, but Dustfinger seized him and pulled him roughly back to his side. "Stay where you are, understand?" he hissed. "I didn't leave them Martins with Roxanne only to have to catch you instead." Silvertongue led the way, with Maggie and Risa behind him. He was holding a sword in his hand, as he had on the night when he turned Capricorn and Basta out of his house. The pregnant woman he had seen in the dungeon was stumbling down the road beside Risa. She kept looking back, up to the Castle of Night, which still towered menacing and huge behind them, even though it was so far away now. There were more prisoners than he had seen at the inn in the forest. Obviously, the Adderhead really had emptied his dungeons. Some were swaying as if they could hardly keep on their feet, others blinking as if even the dim light of this dark day was too much for their eyes. Silvertongue seemed to be all right, in spite of his blood-stained shirt, and Risa did not look quite as pale as in the dungeon, but perhaps that was just his imagination. He had just seen the barn owl among the others. How old and fragile he looked. When Farid clutched his arm in sudden fright and pointed at the men who had appeared suddenly on the road, they emerged so soundlessly that they might have been growing out of the rain, more and more of them, and at first Dustfinger thought the Black Prince had managed to get reinforcements after all. But then he saw Basta. He was holding a sword in one hand and a knife in the other, and bloodlust was written all over his scorched face. None of the men with him wore the Adderhead's coat of arms, but that meant nothing. Perhaps Mortola had sent them. Perhaps the Adderhead wanted to be able to protest innocence when his prisoners were found dead in the road. There were a great many men. That was all that mattered. Dozens and dozens of them. Far more than the robbers lying in wait in the trees with the Black Prince. Basta raised a hand, smiling, and they advanced down the road with drawn swords, going at a comfortable pace as if they wanted to enjoy the fear on the prisoners' faces for a while before they struck. The Black Prince was the first to leap out of the trees with the bear at his side. The two of them took up their position in the road as if they alone could stop the slaughter, but his men were quick to follow, silently forming a wall of bodies between the prisoners and the men who had come to kill them. Cursing quietly, Dustfinger rose to his feet, too. This was going to be a dusk of bloodshed. The rain wouldn't fall fast enough to wash all the blood away, and he would have to provoke the fire to great anger, for it didn't like rain. Damp made it sleepy, and it would have to bite hard, very hard.
Farid!
He breathed the boy's name and was just in time to haul him back by the arm. He wanted to go to Maggie, of course, but he would have to take fire with him. They would need to make a circle of it, a ring of flames around those who had nothing but their hands against all those swords. He picked up a strong branch, enticed the fire from its damp bark, hissing, steaming fire, and threw the burning wood to the boy. The barrier of human flesh wouldn't hold for long. It was fire that must save them. Basta's voice came through the gloom, derisive, bloodthirsty, while Farid made sparks rain down on the ground. He scattered them over the wet earth like a farmer sowing his seed, while Dustfinger followed him and made them grow. The flames were flaring up as Basta's men attacked. Sword clashed against sword. Screams filled the air. Bodies collided as Dustfinger and Farid lured fire into being and nursed it until it almost surrounded the company of prisoners. Dustfinger left only a narrow path free, a way of escape into the forest in case the flames stopped obeying even him, and their anger finally made them bite everyone, friend and foe alike. He saw Risa's face and the fear in it. He saw Farid leap over the flames to join the freed prisoners, in line with their plan. A good thing Maggie was there, or very likely Farid would not have left his side. Dustfinger himself still stood outside the fire. He drew his knife. It was always better to have a knife in your hand when Basta was around. And whispered to the fire, insistently, almost lovingly, to keep it from doing what it wanted and becoming an enemy instead of a friend. As the robbers were forced farther and farther back, they came closer and closer to the troop of freed prisoners. Among them all, only Silvertongue had a weapon. Three of Basta's men were attacking the prince, but the bear was protecting his master with teeth and claws. Dustfinger felt almost sick at the sight of the wounds those black paws inflicted. The fire crackled at him, wanted to play, wanted to dance, didn't understand anything about the fear all around, neither smelled it nor tasted it. Dustfinger heard cries, one as clear as a boy's voice. He pushed his way through the fighting bodies and picked up a sword lying in the mud. Where was Farid? There, thrusting about him with his knife, swift as an adder striking, Dustfinger seized his arm, hissing at the flames to let them pass, and dragged him away.
Damn it all, I ought to have left you with Roxanne!
He shouted as he pushed Farid through the fire.
Didn't I tell you to stay with Maggie?
He could have wrung the boy's thin neck, but he was so relieved to see him uninjured.
Maggie ran to Farid and took his hand. They stood there side by side, staring at the blood and the turmoil, but Dustfinger tried to hear nothing, see nothing. The fire alone was his concern. The rest was up to the prince. Silvertongue was striking out well with his sword, far better than Dustfinger himself could have managed, but his face looked exhausted and wet with rain. Dustfinger glanced at Risa. She was standing beside Maggie, and she was still unhurt. For now. The damn rain was running down his face and the back of his neck, drowning out his voice with its rushing. The water was singing a lullaby to the flames, an ancient lullaby, and Dustfinger raised his voice, called louder and louder to wake it again, to make it roar and bite. He went very near the ring of fire, saw the fighting men come closer and closer. Some were already almost stumbling into the flames. Farid, too, had seen what the rain was doing. He ran nimbly to where the flames were dying down, and Maggie ran after him. A man fell dead in the ring of fire where the boy was standing, extinguishing the flames there with his lifeless body, and a second man stumbled over him. Cursing, Dustfinger made for the deadly breach in the ring, called Silvertongue to help, and saw Basta appear among the flames. Basta, with his face singed and hatred in his eyes, hatred and fear of the fire. Which would prove stronger? He was staring through the flames, blinking at the smoke as if in search of one particular face. Dustfinger could well imagine whose. Instinctively, he took a step back. Another man fell dead in the flames. Two more, swords drawn, leaped over his body and attacked the prisoners. Screams rang in Dustfinger's ears. He saw Silvertongue place himself in front of Risa, while Basta set a foot on the dead men as if they were a bridge. More flames were needed. Dustfinger was making for the fire so that he could hear him better at close quarters, but someone seized his arm and swung him around. Two fingers.
They'll kill us, he stammered, his eyes wide with fear. They're going to kill us all along, and if they don't get us, the flames will burn us alive. Let me go!
Dustfinger shouted at him. The smoke was stinging his eyes and making him cough. Basta. He was staring at him through the smoke as if an invisible bond united them. The flames licked up at him in vain, and he raised his knife. Who was he aiming at, and why was he smiling like that? The boy. Dustfinger pushed the two-fingered man aside. He shouted Farid's name, but the noise all around drowned out his voice. The boy was still holding Maggie's hand with one of his own, while his other hand held the knife that Dustfinger had given him in another life, in another story.
Farid!
The boy did not hear him, and Basta threw. Dustfinger saw the knife go into that thin back. He caught the boy before he fell to the ground, but he was already dead. And there stood Basta with his foot on another dead body, smiling. Why not? He had hit his target, and it was the target he had been aiming for all along. Dustfinger's heart. His stupid heart. It broke in two as he held Farid in his arms. It simply broke in two. Although he had taken such good care of it all these years. He saw Maggie's face, heard her sobbing Farid's name, and put the boy's body into her arms. His legs were trembling so much that he had difficulty in straightening up. Everything about him was trembling, even the hand holding the knife that he had pulled out of the boy's back. He wanted to get at Basta through the fire and the fighting men, but Silvertongue was faster. Silvertongue, who had plucked Farid from his own story, and whose daughter sat there weeping as if her own heart had a knife driven into it, like the boy. Mo ignored the flames moving toward him. He thrust his sword through Basta's body as if he had never done anything else in his life. As if from now on, his trade was killing. Basta died, with an expression of surprise still on his face. He fell into the fire, and Dustfinger stumbled back to Farid, who was still held in Maggie's arms. What had he expected? That the boy would come back to life just because his killer was dead? No. The black eyes were still empty. Empty as a deserted house. There was none of the joy in them now that had always been so difficult to banish. And Dustfinger kneeled there on the trodden earth, while Risa comforted her weeping daughter. And men were fighting, killing, and being killed around them. And he no longer had any idea what he was doing here. What was going on, why he had ever come beneath these trees,
the same trees that he had seen in his dream. In the worst of all dreams. And now, it had come true. Chapter 72. An Exchange. They almost all escaped. The fire saved them, the fury of the bear, the Black Prince's men, and Mo, who practiced killing that gray morning as if he meant to become a master of the craft. Basta was left dead under the trees, along with Slasher, and so many of their men that the ground was covered with their corpses as if with dead leaves. Two of the strolling players had been killed, too. And Farid. Farid. Dustfinger himself was pale as death when he carried him back to the mine. Maggie walked beside him all the long, dark way. She held Farid's hand, as if that could help, feeling as sore inside herself as if it would never get better. She was the only one whom Dustfinger did not send away when he had laid Farid down on his cloak in the most remote of the galleries. No one dared approach him as he bent over the dead boy and wiped the soot from his brow. Roxanne did try to talk to him, but when she saw the expression on his face, she left him alone. He allowed only Maggie to sit beside Farid, as if he had seen his own pain in her eyes. So they both sat with him in the depths of Mount Adder, as if they had come to the end of all stories, without a single word left to say. Perhaps night had fallen outside by the time Maggie heard Dustfinger's voice. It came to her as if from far away, through the fog of pain that enveloped her as if she would never find her way out.
You'd like him back too, wouldn't you?
It was difficult for her to turn her eyes away from Farid's face.
He'll never come back,
she whispered, and looked at Dustfinger. She didn't have the strength to speak any louder. All her strength was gone. As if Farid had taken it away with him. He had taken everything away with him.
There's a story.
Dustfinger looked at his hands as if what he was talking about was written there.
A story about the white woman.
What kind of story? Maggie didn't want to hear any more stories ever again. This one had broken her heart for all time. Nonetheless, there was something in Dustfinger's voice. He bent over Farid and wiped some soot from his cold forehead.
Roxanne knows it, he said. She'll tell it to you. Just go to her and tell her I've had to go away. Tell her I'm going to find out if the story is true.
He spoke with a strange kind of hesitation. As if it were infinitely difficult to find the right words.
And remind her of my promise. That I'll always find a way back to her, wherever I am. Will you tell her that?
What was he talking about?
Find out?
Maggie's voice was husky with tears.
Find out what exactly?
Oh, people say this and that about the white woman. Much of it's just superstition. But there's sure to be some truth in it somewhere. Stories are always like that, aren't they? No doubt Finolio could tell me more, but to be honest, I don't want to ask him. I'd rather ask them in person.
Dustfinger straightened up. He stood there looking around him as if he had forgotten where he really was. The white women.
They'll be coming soon, won't they?
Maggie asked him anxiously.
Coming for Farid? But Dustfinger shook his head, and for the first time since Farid's death, he smiled. That strangely sad smile that Maggie had never seen on any face but his, and that she had never entirely understood.
No. Why should they? They are sure of him already. They come only if you're still clinging to life. If they have to lure you to them with a look or a whispered word. Everything else is superstition. They come while you're still breathing, but very close to death. They come when your heart is beating more and more faintly, when they can smell fear or blood, as in your father's case. If you die as quickly as Farid, you go to them entirely of your own accord. Maggie caressed Farid's fingers. They were colder than the stone where she was sitting. "Then I don't understand," she whispered. "If they aren't coming at all, how will you ask them anything?"
"I shall summon them," replied Dustfinger. "But you had better not be here when I do it. So will you go to Roxanne and tell her what I have said to you?"
She was going to ask more questions, but he put a finger on her lips. "Please, Maggie," he said. He didn't often call her by her name. "Tell Roxanne what I have told you, and say I'm sorry. Now, off you go." Maggie sensed that he was afraid, but she did not ask him what of, because her heart was asking other questions. How could it be true that Farid was dead? And how would it feel to have him dead in her heart forever? She caressed his still face one last time before she got to her feet. When she looked back once more at the entrance to the gallery, Dustfinger was looking down at Farid. And, for the first time since she had known him, his face showed all that he usually hid. Affection, love, and pain. Maggie knew where to look for Roxanne, but she lost her way twice in the dark galleries before she finally found her. Roxanne was tending the injured women, while the barn owl was looking after the men. Many of them had been hurt, and although the fire had saved their lives, it had burned many of them badly. Mo was nowhere to be seen, and nor was the prince. They were probably on guard at the entrance to the mine, but Risa was with Roxanne. She was just bandaging an arm that had suffered burns, and Roxanne was treating a cut on an old woman's forehead with the same ointment she had once used on Dustfinger's wounds. Its spring-like fragrance did not suit this place. When Maggie came out of the dark passage, Roxanne raised her head. Perhaps she'd been hoping that it was Dustfinger's footsteps that she had heard. Maggie leaned back against the cold wall of the gallery. "This is all a dream," she thought, "a terrible, terrible dream." She felt dizzy with weeping. "What's that story?" she asked Roxanne. "A story about the white women? Dustfinger says you're to tell me, and he says he has to go away because he wants to find out if it's true." "Go away?" Roxanne put down the ointment. "What are you talking about?" Maggie wiped her eyes, but there were no tears left in them. She supposed she had used them all up. Where did so many tears come from? "He says he's going to summon them," she murmured. "And he says you're to remember his promise, that he'll always come back. He'll find a way wherever he is." The words still made no sense to her when she repeated them, but they obviously meant something to Roxanne. She straightened up, and so did Risa.
"What are you talking about, Maggie?" asked her mother, with concern in her voice. "Where's Dustfinger?" "With Farid. He's still with Farid. It hurts so much to speak his name."
Risa took her in her arms, but Roxanne just stood there, staring at the dark gallery from which Maggie had come. Then she suddenly pushed Maggie aside, made her way past her, and disappeared into the darkness. Risa hurried after her without letting go of Maggie's hand. Roxanne was only a little way ahead of them. She trod on the hem of her dress, fell over, picked herself up again, and ran on, faster and faster, but she still came too late. Risa almost stumbled into Roxanne, for she was standing rooted to the spot at the entrance of the gallery where Farid lay. Roxanne's name burned on the wall in fiery letters, and the white women were still there. They withdrew their pale hands from Dustfinger's breast as if they had torn out his heart.
Perhaps Roxanne was the last thing he saw. Perhaps he just had time to see Fareed move before he himself collapsed without a sound, as the white women vanished. Yes, Fareed was moving, like someone who had slept too long and too deeply. He sat up, his gaze blurred, with no idea who was suddenly lying there motionless behind him. Even when Roxanne made her way past him, he did not turn. He stared into space as if there were pictures in front of him that no one else could see. Hesitantly, as if he were a stranger, Maggie went to him. She didn't know what to feel. She didn't know what to think. But Roxanne stood beside Dustfinger, her hand pressed firmly to her mouth, as if she had to hold back her pain. Her name was still burning on the wall of the gallery, as if it had stood there forever, but she took no notice of the letters of fire. Without a word, she sank to her knees and took Dustfinger's head on her lap, as carefully as if she feared to break what was already broken, and she bent over him until her black hair surrounded his face like a veil. Risa began to weep. But Fareed still sat there as if numbed. Only when Maggie was right in front of him did he seem to notice her.
"Maggie,"
he murmured, his tongue heavy. It couldn't be true. He was really back. "Fareed." Suddenly his name did not taste of pain. He put his hand out to her and she took it, quickly, as if she had to hold on tight to prevent him from going away again so far away. Was Dustfinger in that place now? How warm Fareed's face felt again. Her fingers couldn't believe it. She kneeled beside him and put her arms around him, much too tight, felt his heart beating against her, beating strongly.
"Maggie!"
He looked as relieved as if he had woken from a bad dream. There was even a smile stealing over his lips, but then Roxanne behind them began sobbing very quietly, so quietly that you could hardly hear it through her curtain of hair. And Fareed turned around. For a moment, he seemed unable to take in what he saw. Then he tore himself away from Maggie, stood up, stumbled over the cloak as if his legs were still too weak for him to walk. He crawled over to Dustfinger's side on his knees and touched the still face with incredulous horror.
"What happened?"
He was shouting at Roxanne as if she were the cause of all misfortune. "What have you done? What have you done to him?" Maggie kneeled down beside him, trying to soothe him, but he wouldn't let her. He pushed her hands away and bent over Dustfinger again, putting an ear to his chest, listening and sobbing as he pressed his face to the place where no heart beat anymore. The Black Prince entered the gallery. Mo was with him, and more faces appeared behind them.
"Go away!"
Fareed shouted at them.
"Go away! All of you! What have you done to him? Why isn't he breathing? There's no blood anywhere! No blood at all!"
"No one did anything to him, Fareed," whispered Maggie.
"You'd like him back too, wouldn't you?"
Maggie heard Dustfinger saying. She kept hearing the words in her head over and over again. "It was the white women. We saw them. He summoned them himself."
"You're lying!"
Fareed was almost shouting at her.
"Why would he do a thing like that?"
But Roxanne ran her finger over Dustfinger's scars. Fine, pale lines. As fine as if a glass man's pen, and not a knife, had drawn them.
"There's a story that the strolling players tell their children," she said without looking at any of them. "About a fire-eater whose son the white women took. In his despair, he remembered something that was said about them. They fear fire, yet long for its warmth. So he decided to summon them by his art, and ask them to give him back his son. It worked. He summoned them with fire. He made it dance and sing for them. And they did not deliver his son to death, but gave him back his life. However, they took the Fire Eater with them, and he never came back. The story says he must live with them forever, until the end of time, and make fire dance for them.
Roxanne picked up Dustfinger's lifeless hand and kissed the soot-blackened fingertips.
"It's only a story," she went on, "but he loved to hear it. He always said it was so beautiful that there must be a grain of truth in it. Whether that's so or not, he's made it come true himself now, and he'll never return, in spite of his promise. Not this time."
Fareed stared at her in horror, watching his face. Miggy saw memory return, the memory of Basta's knife. He reached around to his back, and when he withdrew his hand, his own blood was sticking to his fingers. His tunic was still damp with it.
"You were dead, Fareed," Miggy whispered. "And Dustfinger brought you back."
She closed her eyes so as not to see that motionless figure anymore. She wanted to see other pictures. Dustfinger breathing fire for her in Eleanor's garden, or guiding her and Mo through the hills away from Capricorn's dreadful village, and his happiness when she first saw him in his own world. He had both betrayed and rescued her. And now, he had given her Fareed back. Tears were running down her face, and she hardly noticed when her mother kneeled down beside her. It was a long night. Roxanne and the prince kept watch by Dustfinger's side, but Fareed had climbed out of the mine to where the moon was showing through the black clouds, and mist rose from the ground that was wet with rain. He had pushed aside the guards who had tried to stop him and thrown himself down on the moss. He lay there now under Mortola's venomous trees, sobbing, while the two Martins scuffled in the darkness as if they still had a master to quarrel over. Of course Maggie went to him, but Fareed sent her away. So she set off to find Mo. Risa was asleep beside him, her face wet with tears, but Mo was awake. He sat there with his arm around her sleeping mother and looked into the darkness as if a story was written there, a story that he didn't yet understand. For the first time, Maggie couldn't read in his face what he was thinking. There was something strange and closed in it, hard as the scab over a wound. But when he noticed her inquiring look, he smiled at her, and all the strangeness was gone. "Come here," he said softly, and she sat down beside him and pressed her face into his shoulder.
"I want to go home, Mo," she whispered.
"No, you don't," he whispered back, and she sobbed into his shirt, as she'd done so often when she was a little girl. She had been able to unload all her grief onto him, however heavily it weighed. Mo had brushed it away simply by stroking her hair, putting his hand on her brow, and whispering her name. And that was what he did now in this sad place, on this sad night. He couldn't take away all the pain. There was too much of it. But he could help just by holding her close. No one could do it better. Not Risa. Not even Fareed. Yes, it was a long night. As long as 1,000 nights. Darker than any that Maggie had ever known. And she didn't know how long she had been sleeping beside Mo when Fareed was suddenly shaking her awake. He led her off with him, away from her sleeping parents, into a dark corner that smelled of the prince's bear.
"Maggie,"
he whispered, taking her hand between his and pressing it so hard that it hurt.
"I know how we can make everything right again. You go to Fenolio. Tell him to write something that will bring Dustfinger back to life. He'll listen to you."
Of course. She might have known he would think up this idea. He was looking at her so pleadingly that it hurt. But she shook her head.
"No, Fareed. Dustfinger is dead. Fenolio can't do anything for him. And even if he could, haven't you heard what he keeps muttering to himself? He says he'll never write another word, not after what happened to Cosimo."
Fenolio had indeed changed. Maggie had hardly recognized him when she saw him again. Once his eyes had always reminded her of a little boy's. Now, they were an old man's eyes.
His gaze was suspicious, uncertain, as if he didn't trust the ground under his feet anymore. And since Cosmo's death, he cared nothing for shaving himself, combing his hair, or washing. He had asked only about the book that Mo had bound. But not even Meggie's assurance that its blank pages did indeed ward off death had wiped the bitterness from his face.
"Oh, wonderful," he had muttered. "The Adderhead's immortal, and Cosmo's dead as a doornail. Nothing goes right with this story anymore."
And he had gone off again, far from all the others. No, Fenelia wouldn't help anyone anymore, not even himself. All the same, when Farid set off in search of him, Meggie went too. Fenelia was spending most of his time these days in one of the deepest galleries of the mine, a place almost entirely filled with rubble, to which no one else climbed down. He was asleep when they clambered down the steep ladder. The fur that the robbers had given him drawn up to his chin, his old forehead wrinkled as if he were thinking hard even in his dreams.
"Fenelio!"
Farid roughly shook him awake. The old man turned over on his back with a grunt that would have done the prince's bear credit. Then he opened his eyes and stared at Farid as if seeing his dark face for the very first time.
"It's you,"
he growled, dazed with sleep, and propped himself on his elbows.
"The boy who came back from the dead. Something else that I never wrote. What do you want? You know, I was just having my first good dream for days."
"You must write us something."
"Write something? I'm never going to write again. Haven't we seen what comes of it? I had this fabulous idea about the Book of Immortality that will set the good characters free and bring the Adderhead to his death in the most subtle way. And what happens? The Adder is immortal now, and the forest is full of corpses again. Robbers, strolling players, the two-fingered man. Dead. Why do I keep making them up if this story is only going to kill them? Oh, this thrice-accursed story. It's in love with death."
"But you must bring him back."
Farid's lips were trembling.
"You made the Adderhead immortal, so why not him?"
"You're talking about Dustfinger, aren't you?"
Fenelio sat up and rubbed his face, sighing heavily.
"Yes, he's dead now, too. Dead as a doornail. But I planned that a long way back, as you perhaps remember. Be that as it may, Dustfinger is dead. You were dead. Minerva's husband, Cosmo, the boys who rode with him, they're all dead. Can't this story think of anything else? I'll tell you something, my boy. I'm not its author anymore. No. The author is death. The Grim Reaper, the Cold Man, call him what you like. It's his dance. And never mind what I write, he'll take my words and make them serve him."
"Nonsense!"
Farid was no longer even wiping away the tears that streamed down his face.
"You must fetch him back. It wasn't his death at all, it was mine. Make him breathe again. It will only take a few words. After all, you did it for Cosimo and for Silvertongue."
"Just a moment. Meggie's father wasn't dead yet," Fenelio soberly pointed out. "And as for Cosimo, he only looked like Cosimo. How many more times do I have to explain that? Meggie and I made a brand new Cosimo, and unfortunately, it went terribly wrong. No."
He reached into his belt, produced something resembling a handkerchief, and blew his nose noisily.
"This is not a story in which the dead come to life, all right? I admit I brought immortality into it, yes, but that's different from bringing back the dead. No, when someone is dead here, he stays dead. It's the same in this world as the one I come from. Dustfinger got around that rule very cleverly on your behalf. Perhaps I wrote the sentimental story that gave him the idea myself. I don't really remember, but never mind, there are always gaps. And he paid for your life with his own. That's always been the only trade-off that death will accept.
Who'd have thought it? Dustfinger, of all people, gets so fond of a good-for-nothing boy that he ends up dying for him. I admit it's a much better idea than one about that Martin, but it isn't mine. Oh, no. So if you're looking for someone to blame, then blame yourself. Because one thing is certain, my boy.
And so saying, he jabbed his finger roughly into Fareed's thin chest.
And it's that you don't belong in this story. And if you hadn't taken it into your head to wangle your way into it, Dustfinger would still be alive.
Fareed punched Fenolio in the face before Maggie could pull him back.
How can you say a thing like that?
She shouted at Fenolio as Fareed, sobbing, put his arms around her.
Fareed saved Dustfinger at the mill. He protected him ever since he arrived here.
Yes, yes, all right, growled Fenolio, feeling his nose. It hurt. I'm a heartless old man, I know, but although you may not believe it, I felt dreadful when I saw Dustfinger lying there. And then Roxanne's tears, appalling, really appalling. All the wounded men, Maggie, all the dead, so many dead. No, Maggie, the words don't obey me anymore, except when it suits them. They've turned against me like snakes.
Exactly. You're a failure, a miserable failure.
Fareed shook Maggie off.
You don't know your own trade, but someone else does. The man who brought Dustfinger here, Orpheus. He'll get him back. You wait and see. Write him here. You can at least do that. Yes, write Orpheus here at once, or I'll tell the Arrowhead you were going to kill him. I'll tell all the women in Umbra it's your fault their menfolk died.
He stood there with his fists clenched, quivering with rage and despair, but the old man just looked at him. Then with difficulty, he rose to his feet.
You know something, my boy,
he said, putting his face very close to Fareed's.
If you'd asked me nicely, I might have tried. But not this way. No. No. Fenolio must be asked, not threatened. I still have that much pride left.
At this, Fareed looked like going for him again, but Maggie held him back.
Fenolio, stop it!
She shouted at the old man.
He's desperate, can't you see that?
Desperate? So what? I'm desperate, too!
Fenolio snapped at her.
My story is foundering in misfortune, and these hands here,
he said, holding them out to her,
don't want to write anymore. I'm afraid of words, Maggie. Once they were like honey, now they're poison, pure poison. But what is a writer who doesn't love words anymore? What have I come to? This story is devouring me, crushing me, and I'm its creator.
Fetch Orpheus, said Fareed hoarsely.
Maggie could hear how much trouble he was taking to control his voice, to banish the rage from it.
Bring him here and let him write it for you. Teach him what you know, the way Dustfinger taught me everything. Let him find the right words for you. He loves your story. He told Dustfinger so himself. He even wrote you a letter when he was a boy.
Did he?
For a moment, Fenolio sounded almost like his old inquisitive self.
Yes, he admires you. He thinks this is the best of all stories. He said so.
Really? Fenolio sounded flattered.
Well, that isn't bad. That is to say, it wasn't bad.
He looked thoughtfully at Fareed.
A pupil. A pupil for Fenolio,
he murmured.
A writer's apprentice. Orpheus.
He spoke the name as if he had to taste it.
The only poet who ever challenged death. Appropriate.
Fareed was looking at him so hopefully that it went to Maggie's heart again. But Fenolio smiled, even though it was a sad smile.
Look at him, Maggie, he said. He has the same pleading look as my grandchildren could turn on to wheedle anything out of me. Does he look at you the same way when he wants something for you?
Maggie felt herself blushing. However, Fenolio turned back to Fareed.
You know we'll need Maggie's help, don't you?
Fareed nodded and looked at her. I'll read it, she said quietly. If Finolio writes it, I'll read it. And get the man who helped